All right, we're in Matthew chapter 24 this morning. We're going to look at verse 46, which is our beatitude. And to talk about it, we're going to look at chapters 24 and 25 of Matthew, which are fascinating and important teachings of Jesus and important for us to study and to understand, but also because of the beatitude that is taught here. And of course, we're talking now about beatitudes that have to do with the kingdom of Christ and the kind of heart, kind of attitude a person must have in order to remain faithful in that kingdom and make it to that eternal kingdom of heaven. So in this statement here in verse 46, Jesus says, "Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing." So our beatitude and the lesson we're going to talk about from this is that the blessed man is the one who is faithful to Jesus, who, when Jesus returns, he finds his servant doing his will. And so to be one of the blessed, we have to be faithful to the Lord. And to understand that, we want to talk about it in the context of what Jesus is discussing here in Matthew 24. So when you go back to the first verse of this chapter, it says that Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." And so the context of Matthew 24 is that Jesus and his disciples are leaving the temple, and as they do, his disciples turn to the temple and are showing it to him. And we may say, well, why are they showing Jesus the temple? He's been coming to the temple since he was a little child. We know he was there when he was 12 years old, right? So Jesus knows the temple. He knows what it looks like and all of those things. Well, they're pointing out the buildings of the temple and showing him all of the elaborate construction of the temple, because he's begun telling them that the temple is going to be destroyed. And in their mind, if the temple of God is destroyed, you know, that's the end of everything. That happened when they went into captivity, but they came back from captivity, and now they're the people of God again, and so this is supposed to continue. They failed to understand, of course, ultimately what Jesus was talking about with his kingdom, that he's setting up a spiritual kingdom that's not going to be the physical nation of Israel. And that entire system and economy and all of that is going to come to an end. God's going to bring judgment upon them for all of their rejection of God down through the ages, and now culminating in their rejection of his only begotten Son and crucifixion of him. And so Jesus says, you know, I see it, but you look at it. He says, you see all these things? I'm telling you, and this is the truth, Jesus says, there's not going to be one stone left upon another. So to explain that to his disciples, in verse 3 it says, as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, so they left the temple, left Jerusalem, went down through the Kidron Valley, up on the hill on the other side at the Mount of Olives. So from the Mount of Olives, you can look back across and you can see the temple on top of the hill there, right? So they're on the other side looking back toward the temple. And Jesus says unto them privately, tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, to them, in their mind, they're talking about one event. The temple is destroyed. That means Jesus is coming back and judging the world, and the world ends. And what Jesus does in answering their question is to answer them as they ask them, and to show that there's a difference between the destruction of Jerusalem and the end of the world. So starting in verse number 4, down through verse 35 of chapter 24, Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And that's going to happen in the year AD 70 by the Roman army. And so just notice a couple of things that he says. In verse 4, he answered and said unto them, "Take heed that no man deceive you." So he wants them to know the truth. He says, "For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye not be troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. And he goes on, he talks about in verse 7, nation rising against nation, kingdom against kingdom, famine, pestilence, earthquakes in divers places. He says all these are the beginning of sorrows. They're going to be persecuted, they're going to be false prophets. And he says in verse 13, he that shall endure unto the end shall be saved. So in all of these things, Jesus says, you know, this is what's going to happen in the world that we live in. And you're not to let these things upset you or cause you to be worried, because, of course, God is in control and he has a plan, and it's going to happen when God says that it will. So when you come down then to verse, let's say, 29, he says, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with the great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. And when you read that passage, it sounds like he's talking about the end of time, but he's not. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And as we've studied in the book of Revelation, we read this language about stars falling and powers falling and being shaken. And we learn from the Old Testament scriptures that that had to do with leaders or nations that had great power and influence being cast down. And that's what he's talking about, the end of Judaism and the Jewish nation with the destruction of Jerusalem. So he talks about the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and people read that and they say, well, this is Jesus coming. You know, you look up and you see him in heaven, right? But it's actually the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, meaning the Son of Man is in heaven. The sign is that Jesus is going to ascend from the earth and go back to heaven, and he's going to bring judgment on Jerusalem in AD 70. Not that he's literally coming back from heaven, he's in heaven, and he's going to bring this destruction upon them. And so the elect are going to be gathered, and they're going to escape, but Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. Now, to explain that, verse 32, he teaches a parable. Learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, you know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. And so Jesus says, what I've told you in this speech that he's given here is telling you, you know, things that are going to happen, but then there's the sign of his coming, which we learn, and from the other accounts also, is the abomination of desolation, the Roman army surrounding Jerusalem, going into the temple. That was the sign that when they saw that, they were to flee the city. And so Jesus says, when the fig tree, you know, puts forth the branch, you know it's almost summer. So when you see these things happen, you know the destruction of Jerusalem is near, right? But notice and understand the importance of verse 34, this generation. People read this passage today and they say, when Jesus said this generation, he actually meant this generation, our generation. And they've been saying that for generations. Generations ago, people said Jesus was giving us signs for the end of the world, and it's going to happen in our generation. And that entire generation has died, and it didn't happen. So now they say it's this generation today. And, you know, the next generation, they'll say it's that generation. But it was the generation of people who were living at the time that Jesus taught this. So Jesus is teaching around AD 30 or so. Jerusalem's destroyed in AD 70. That's within that generation, 40 years, right? So that's what he's talking about here, the destruction of Jerusalem. But then he makes a change in verse 36. So if you read through that passage closely, you'll notice that phrase, these things. He says it over and over again. But then in verse 36, he says, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. So he's been talking about these things, and that has to do with the destruction of Jerusalem, but now he's talking about that day. So not these things leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem, but that day at the end of time when Jesus is going to return and judge the world. Not just Jerusalem, but the world. And he says, of that day and hour knoweth no man. So there were things that would happen that would tell them the destruction of Jerusalem was approaching. When they saw the Roman army come in and surround the city, Jesus had told the faithful and told the Christians, when that happens, that's it, right? They're not going to leave. The nation of Judah and Israel is not going to get out of this. When you see the Roman army come in, that's your warning sign to get out, because they're going to destroy that place. And the faithful listened, and they did. But when it comes to the day of judgment, there are no signs. Nobody knows when that's going to happen. He says the Father knows. And in the other accounts, Jesus even says that he, the Son, does not know that day. And that's an important thing to notice also. There are people who will try to use that as an argument against the deity of Christ. They'll say, if Jesus is God, then why didn't he know the day when he was going to come back? You know, if he's God, then he should know that, right? And the fact that he doesn't means that he's not God. And what people fail to understand from that is the incarnation of Jesus. See, think about Jesus. You know, the characteristics of deity is omniscience, all-knowing. God knows everything. It's being omnipresent. God is everywhere at once. He's not confined to one place. All of those, you know, omnipotence, has all power. Well, when Jesus allowed himself to leave heaven and to come to earth as a man, he sacrificed those things. When Jesus was on the earth, he was no longer omnipresent. He wasn't everywhere at once anymore. He was confined to that body. And wherever his physical body was, that's where Jesus was. That didn't take away his deity, but it's part of what he gave up to become man like us so he could die for us. And that's what Philippians 2 is talking about when it says he thought it not robbery to be equal with God. When he gave up those aspects of deity to be one of us, he didn't feel like he was being robbed of anything. He was willing to make that sacrifice. So part of that sacrifice was also omniscience. Jesus didn't know everything anymore because he was in a human body. And so he didn't know the day he was going to return. Only the Father knew that, because he had surrendered that so he could be a man for us and to die for us. And that's beyond comprehension how God can do that and willingly do that and do that for us. But that's what Jesus did. And so he says the Father knows. And so that means I don't know, and you don't know, and no man knows, and nobody can figure it out because God hasn't revealed it to us. So as you go on through the end of that chapter, verse 37, for example, he says, but as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. So man was just going about his life, and then the flood came. They didn't see any signs leading up to it, right? The sky didn't get cloudy, and it starts, you know, there's a storm building, but the earth broke open and water shot up from the fountains of the great deep, you know, and the whole thing fell apart. Instantly and immediately, God brought this upon the world. And so it was, you know, an act of judgment by God that there were no warning signs for, except for the preaching of Noah that this day was coming. So that's how it will be at the end of time when Jesus comes back. We don't know when that's going to be, but it will happen. In the blink of an eye, he will appear and the world will be destroyed according to his plan and to his purpose. So he says in verse 42, watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. And so that's the context of this beatitude. The servant who is blessed is the one who is doing the Lord's will when he returns, knowing that we can't know when he's going to return. And so it's the principle of being faithful, always doing the Lord's will, because we're not aware of the time when he's going to come back. So to illustrate that, Jesus gives two examples. First of all, here in verse 42, we just read, verse 43, he says, "But know this, that if the goodman of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore, be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh." And so the first illustration is of a thief breaking into your house. If you knew when that was going to happen, then you'd be prepared, right? And you wouldn't allow him to do that. You would protect your house and defend yourself and whatever. But we don't know when a thief is going to come. That's the whole point of a thief, right? So Jesus says that the illustration to always watch and always be ready because we don't know the hour. And then the second illustration in verse 45, "Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season?" So that's the question. The answer is, "Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods." So the servant is, he's been given this position of stewardship over his master's household. He's responsible for it to see that it is cared for, that it runs the way that the master wants it to, that everything's happening according to his plan and his will. And when the master returns, if the servant is doing that, he's a faithful servant and he's blessed. And the master will promote him and reward him for his faithfulness. But the other side of that is verse 48. "But and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth." So if the servant says, well, he's not coming back today, so I have time to do what I want to do and mistreat other people and, you know, eat and drink with the drunken and those things that he talks about here. And so he's not managing the household for the master, but he's using those things for himself. When the Lord returns, he sees this is not a faithful servant. In fact, he's called evil and he's punished. So that's the illustration. The thief, we don't know when he's going to come. If we did, we'd be prepared. And a servant who is a steward over a household, we don't know when the master is going to return. So we have to live and serve every day as though today is the day that the master will come back in order to be found faithful. So the unfaithful servant is punished. The faithful servant is rewarded. So those illustrate the beatitude. Blessed is the servant who is faithful to the Lord, who his Lord finds so doing. So what does all that mean, and what does this beatitude mean? Well, that's what chapter 25 of Matthew is about. Jesus tells three parables. Two are parables, I guess. One maybe is not a parable at the end, but there are three illustrations of the principles that he's talking about when it comes to faithfulness and being the faithful servant and a faithful steward. So the first is, of course, the overall principle is, when the Lord returns, we want to be found faithfully obeying and doing his will. And there are three ways he illustrates that. Number one is by faithfully watching. And that's verses 1 through 13 of 25 and the parable of the foolish and the wise virgins. So let's read it quickly here. It says, "Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins, which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were wise and five were foolish. They that were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them, but the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. While the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight there was a cry made, behold, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said unto the wise, Give us of your oil, for our lamps are gone out. But the wise answered, saying, Not so, lest there be not enough for us and you. But go ye rather to them that sell, and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready went in with him to the marriage, and the door was shut. Afterward came also the other virgins, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, Verily I say unto you, I know you not. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. So again, unlike the destruction of Jerusalem, we don't know the day when Jesus is going to return, and so we have to always be watching. And that's the lesson of the parable. And the illustration, of course, comes from the marriage traditions and customs in those days. But the bridegroom is, of course, returning, and it's time to go to the marriage feast. He's coming to get his bride, and they're going to go to the wedding and the feast and all of that. And the virgins who are with her are to be prepared for that. So five of them were and five weren't. The ones who were prepared not only brought their lamps, but they brought extra oil. And the ones who were not prepared didn't bring extra oil. And so the lesson of the parable, and you remember when we talk about parables, there's only one lesson. There's only one, you know, message in the parable. And sometimes we, you know, kind of apply all kinds of different things. But the message of the parable is to be watching, to be prepared, because we don't know when Jesus is going to return. So don't let your oil run out. Right? Don't stop watching. Don't become complacent and think, well, today's not the day. He's not going to return today, because he very well could. And don't start to live a life, you know, that is where you're not, you know, with your oil ready and your lamp burning and ready to meet the bridegroom. So don't start a lifestyle of sin and think, well, you know, I'm just going to do this for a little while and then I'm going to come back to the Lord, because he may return while we're away before we come back. And so have enough oil that you can last through however long life is. And so there's a great lesson there about not giving up, that just because I was faithful in my younger days doesn't mean I don't have to be faithful when I'm older. Just because I served God then doesn't mean I don't have to serve him now. But having oil for our lamps means that we keep on faithfully watching and doing what the Lord says. And that kind of goes into the second illustration here, the parable of the talents, where we learn that a faithful servant is one who is faithfully growing. So in the parable of the talents, we won't read every verse just because it's so long here, but verse 14 sets the stage. The kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. So notice that it says here that he called his own servants. So the master of the household is calling his servants and giving them these amounts of money to use in service to him. Back in the first parable of the virgins, you remember that when they came to the door, they said, Lord, Lord, open to us. So they knew who Jesus was, and Jesus knew who they were, but because they were unfaithful and the doors closed, he no longer has fellowship with them. And so he says, I know you not. So they had started out faithful, but they became unfaithful, and that separated them from the Lord. Here, these are the master's servants. So he's not talking about people in the world. Jesus is talking about us, his people, his disciples. And he's saying that we all have talents. And talents here, of course, is money. They're given amounts of money. And each of them are supposed to use that money to best benefit the household of the master. And we can apply that to any number of things in our lives, to money and how we use our material possessions to serve the Lord, but also to our abilities and our literal talents, right? The things that we're able to do, how do we use them in service to the Lord? And so he says that they were given according to their ability. So a man who had shown that he had ability in managing money or in using money in the master's household, he was given more than someone who didn't demonstrate that kind of ability. And that's not a matter of judgment in the sense that one was saved and the other was lost. It just means this wasn't, you know, where his talents were. But they could still use what they had to serve the Lord. And so we have different abilities or different talents, different areas that we can work in and serve in. And yours may be different from mine. And mine may be different from yours. But whatever it is, the Lord wants us to use that to serve him. So one man was given five talents, and of course he went out and earned five more. One was given two, and he earned two more. And then there was the one who was given one talent, and he hid it in the ground. So verse 24 says that then he which had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee, that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His Lord answered and said unto him, thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury or with interest. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And so the response to this servant is very different from the response to the faithful servants. They were called good and faithful servants. And they'd been faithful over a few things. The Lord said, I'll make you ruler over many things. And so they showed that they could use what their master had given them to his benefit, to the benefit of his household. And so they were given more responsibilities and more opportunities to serve. The one who didn't, of course, not only was he not given any more responsibility to serve, but the one he had been given was taken away from him. And he was told, to cast him into outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that, of course, represents again, the day of judgment, when the Lord comes, those who have used what God has given them to his benefit and to the service of his kingdom will be welcomed by the Lord into his eternal kingdom as good and faithful servants. But those who haven't, those who have hidden their talents or whatever it is that God has given us that we can use in his service, but we've refused to do that, then like this servant, will be called wicked and slothful or lazy and receive that condemnation of being cast into outer darkness because we didn't use what God has given us to honor him and to serve him. So take those two parables or two stories here and put them together. The first one is emphasizing, that to be faithful, you have to be faithfully watching, always on guard, always ready for the day when the Lord returns, knowing that it could be any day. We live serving him faithfully every day. And then the second one demonstrates how we serve him faithfully every day. And it's by taking what he has given us and using it and then growing in it to be able to do more. And that's an important part of this parable, that when they did well, they were given more talents to be able to do more in the Lord's service. And sometimes I think that when we do what we can in service to God, we do it hoping that if I just do this and use this ability and this talent and serve in this way, that that's all I have to do and God doesn't give me any more responsibility or any more opportunities. because I don't want to have to do more and sacrifice more and spend more time studying His Word or teaching His Word or helping people who are in need or whatever it is. I want to be able to do just this little bit and be done with it, right? And punch my ticket to heaven. But that's not the way it works at being a Christian, being a disciple. It's not about the least that we can do. It's about welcoming the opportunity to do more. And so part of being faithful is growing in our faithfulness. That I was faithful in this when I was younger, and now I'm faithful in more things. Like I could just lead singing when I was younger, but now I lead prayer, and now I teach a lesson, and now I'm preaching, and now I'm talking to my neighbors, and now, you know, all these other things that we do as Christians, we have to grow in those things. And that's what it looks like to be faithful. It's not just to do one thing and stay with that one thing and never reach out and do anything else, but it's to grow. And that's what these talents are illustrating. And then the third, of course, is to be found faithfully serving. And that's the end of the chapter where Jesus talks about those who, you know, he separates the sheep from the goat. And he talks about those who had helped others and those who hadn't. Verse 35, he says, "For I was an hungered and you gave me meat. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. Naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came unto me." And the righteous will say, "When did we do this?" And Jesus will say, "When you did it to the least of these." And the opposite of that, of course, were those who, verse 42, "I was a hungered and you gave me no meat. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you took me not in. Naked and you clothed me not. Sick and in prison and you visited me not." And they will also say, "Well, when did we not do this to you, Lord?" And he'll say, "When you didn't do it to others." And so the principle, of course, is the principle of serving. That when the sheep are divided from the goats, the righteous from the unrighteous, the difference between the two is that one did what the Lord said to do and the other did not. Had good intentions, probably. Would say in their hearts that they loved the poor and they cared, you know, desperately about those who were in need and they wanted good things for them, but they never did anything about it. It's the person who says, "I love my neighbor and I want them to go to heaven, but I never talk to them about the Bible." It's the person who says, "I want the church to be strong and to grow," but they never do anything to help it, right? Good intentions are good, but they alone cannot save us. It's good to say the words that I love the Lord, but it's different from showing in action that I love the Lord. And so watching, being faithful in our watching and in our growing, means also being faithful in our serving, to actually do what the Bible tells us to do, what the Lord tells us to do. And that's the only way to be one of the blessed, to be faithful in the Lord's kingdom, and to be welcomed to that eternal kingdom in heaven. I have to be faithfully doing and serving the way that the Lord asks me to. And so they could know when Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. And the Lord deliberately and specifically warned them so those Christians could get out of that city and avoid the destruction that was about to take place. And also so that when it happened, Christians knew, and we today know, that this was God's judgment on the nation of Israel. And it was the end of it, and God never intends for it to be restored or reestablished. But when it comes to Jesus' return, we don't know when that's going to happen. So if I want to be one of the blessed and to be welcomed into that eternal home in heaven, I have to be found faithful when the Lord returns. Watching for him, growing and serving faithfully, continually on a daily basis, doing all those things that the Lord wants me to do. And that's how to be one of the blessed and to receive the eternal home in heaven. So that's our beatitude today. That's the last one in the book of Matthew also. So Lord willing, next time we're going to move over further into the New Testament and start to get into some of these in the epistles as well. But anyway, we'll stop here. Pick up with our next one next time.